And welcome to an hour of Mind Power. This is Donna Sebo, and have we got a provocative hour for you. If it doesn't make those little gray cells of yours work overtime, well, I don't know what could possibly make that happen. Now, for those of you who are tuning in for the first time, we're so glad you're part of our listening family. Welcome. Tell your friends. Also note that you can call in later on in the hour, toll-free if you like, 877-876-5227. Now, for those of you who are regular listeners to the broadcast, you realize that I have people from all over the world, from all kinds of backgrounds. And today we're going to be talking with Dr. Bernard Heisch, and this man has such a fascinating background. Do you mind if I call you Bernard?
That would be just fine.
Thank you, Bernard. I am really thrilled to have you on the air. Your book called The God Theory is so fascinating because you go into universes, zero-point fields, and all kinds of information that for most of us, if we're not science majors, we'd think, well, maybe this is going to be over my head, but that's not the case. I want to tell my audience a little bit about you. You are an astrophysicist. You have published over 130 scientific publications. You were at one time a scientific editor of the Astrophysical Journal. In fact, you did that for well over 10 years. And then you got your PhD from the University of Wisconsin in Madison, and you did your postdoctoral research at the Joint Institute for Laboratory Astrophysics, the University of Colorado Boulder and the University of Utrecht in the Netherlands. And you have been a staff scientist at the Lockheed Martin Solar and Astrophysics Laboratory, also a deputy director of the Center for Extreme Ultraviolet Astrophysics at the University of California, Berkeley. And you have just got, I mean, it's just incredible, all of these things that you have done. You also have been in seminary. You were a student for the Catholic priesthood at one time. Now you are married, you have three children, and you live in San Francisco. Your life is so interesting. It's so intriguing because it's as if, in a way, you went one path and ended up 180 degrees different from where you imagined you were going to end up.
Well, in a way, that's just not entirely true, because when I was just a little kid, I had this notion that there were two things I was going to do in life. One was become a Catholic priest, and that was no doubt due to some of my mother's fervent prayers. And the other was to become an astronomer.
Uh-huh.
And in fact, those two things are not totally incompatible. I know some Jesuit astronomers that do research and are in good standing in the astronomical world. So the two can be done together. And I grew up thinking I would do them both. But after I spent my first year in the seminary, or in fact, after I spent my first few days in the college seminary, I realized that I probably wanted to live a more, shall we say, secular life and get married and have kids and pursue the astronomy and then not the priesthood.
Now, you have been a professional scientist, and I'd like to call you a curiosity seeker. I mean, you just have this interest in life, and it's throughout your book, the feeling I had was you love to take positionings with that aspect of curiosity to find out what other paradigms there are out there. What do you think was a stimulus for that? Was there anything particular when you were a child that stimulated this particular patterning of thinking?
Well, I guess it was the interest in space that did it. I always imagined traveling through space when I was a kid. The not-that-old Palomar Observatory was a source of inspiration when I saw the images taken by the huge telescope. And then when Sputnik came along and we entered the space age and the moon launches took place, and I was still in high school, that really inspired me to think about all the possibilities of what could be out there. And I guess that's the kind of overall interest that that spurred all the strange things I've done in my life.
Well, I think they're exciting. Now, I want to read verbatim from your introduction, because it is, again, to me, provocative thinking. You say, much of today's religious dogma concerning God, the nature and destiny of mankind is flawed and irrational. It fails to resolve basic paradoxes, like why bad things happen to good people and why some are born into privilege and some into starvation and misery. Moreover, the conflicting claims of the world's religions contribute widely and directly to the violence and hatred that afflicts much of the planet. On the other hand, rejecting anything that people would call supernatural in the name of science is equally flawed and irrational. That would, I can imagine, spark so many fascinating conversations, just that grouping of thought.
Well, it could. I'm trying to differentiate between religion and spirituality in my book, because I think that, on the one hand, religion has been really rather unconscionably responsible for a huge amount of human misery, when it shouldn't be. I mean, religion should be the embodiment of noble thinking and inspirational thought. But unfortunately, it hasn't been in the past, and in many parts of the world, it is still not today. But spirituality is a totally different thing. I think of spirituality as being a body of knowledge, and I'm hoping someday that spirituality might stand side by side with other bodies of knowledge like astronomy, biology, chemistry, physics. Spirituality belongs on that sort of level as something we can study. And I think separating spirituality from religion would be a healthy thing for civilization, which is not to say that all religion is bad, but a lot of it has been, unfortunately, less than it could have been, and in some cases has resulted in some real human tragedies.
Well, I feel that most of us would, if we look at our world today, would say there's a lot of truth in that. And why is it that hate is nurtured and perpetuated by that which should not be nurturing or perpetuating it? And I think this throughout history, this has been consistent, at least the history that I've read, over and over again, in all parts of the world. It's not just a segment, it's all over the world.
That's true. I mean, it's amazing to me that a religious institution would carry out, say, a medieval inquisition and murder people in the name of the Prince of Peace. It's simply absurd. But that doesn't mean that we should throw out all notions of spirituality. In fact, quite the opposite. I think the recognition that there is a spiritual reality that parallels and is perhaps separate from the scientific reality that we study with our telescopes and microscopes, it's important to recognize that and to separate the bad elements of political religion from the truth of spirituality that I think we're only on the verge of beginning to explore and discover.
You have a question that is relating, and this is in the first part of your book. You call it The God Theory, Karma and the Golden Rule. You ask this question: why would an individualized spark of divine consciousness choose to limit its experience of physical existence to only, say, 80 years of life in Bakersfield?
I've got to apologize to Bakersfield. I drove through it only yesterday. It was perhaps a cheap shot, but I think I get my message across.
I thought that was so fascinating, because you've gone in and studied so many different aspects, but science has had such a link with your studies. And I'm just intrigued with this whole picture, because it gives a much different view than many people would ever expect a scientist to have. In fact, people many times in conversations, they say, well, science has become like a religion to so many individuals. And you have that comes out. You say today the word science is used in two very different ways. Tell us what those ways are.
Well, science as a way to explore reality is perfectly valid. In fact, you know, the things that we have learned from science, the technologies we've gained, they're indisputable. So science as a way of studying reality, a certain kind of reality, physical reality, that's fine. But science as a belief system, as something that limits your thinking to the physical and assumes that anything that can't be measured objectively, that can't be viewed with a telescope, can't be imaged with a microscope, can't be prodded and probed, has to be unreal. That's science that has become a dogma. That's science that has crossed the line from science into scientism, and that's what I object to. Now, the ideas in my book kind of stem from the findings of astrophysics. There are at least seven properties of the universe that are just right for life to evolve, and if they were any different, we wouldn't be here. Now, my saying that is not a controversial thing, actually. That's standard astrophysics these days, because, in fact, we can discuss these properties later in the program, if you wish. But there are books out by respected physicists and astronomers that talk about these unusual sort of tailor-made properties of the universe. For example, Sir Martin Rees, the British cosmologist and former Astronomer Royal, has a book out talking about the numbers that are just right for life to evolve. And Leonard Susskind, a well-known Stanford professor, also talks about these sorts of things. So you have a universe that seems to be fine-tuned for life to evolve in it. How can that come about? Now, I've got to say that Sir Martin Rees's answer to that would be very different than mine. But we're both confronted with the same data, which is that the universe is just right for life. And I take the position that that implies that there's probably a purpose behind it. And a more conventional scientific interpretation would be that, well, if this is a just right universe, there must be lots of others that are not just right, because it all has to be random. So if it's just right here, that's got to imply that there may be millions, perhaps even an infinite number, of other universes that are all very different than this one. And we only seem to be in the just right one because we couldn't be in any other one. So there's a very different view that you can take of why our universe seems to have just right properties for us. And I think they're both equally logical and equally valid. But I do think that the one that I'm proposing, which is that there is a transcendent consciousness behind it, that actually has a bit more evidence behind it. Because you can't simply throw out all of the historical evidence of the mystics and the spontaneous human experiences and the prayerful episodes that people have and dismiss all of that. I tend to take that as evidence that's on a par with the scientific evidence.
One of the comments I'd like to make relative to what you have just said is that if one is willing to read and if one is willing to study different cultures, you don't have to be an astrophysicist to do this. You can go to your local library. But there is not a culture in the world that has not had these very experiences that you talk about. And you can't ignore them. I don't see how you can. I know there are people that are that will say, oh, it's just psychological, or there's this, that, or the other that they'll claim. But there is a lot more to it. There is just so much that's gone on and so many various experiences that people have been through throughout the world. You're right. You just can't close your eyes after a while. It's not exclusive to any culture, any people, any time zone. It just is.
Let me give an interesting example of how I think that we are able ultimately to tune into some kind of consciousness that is really what we're experiencing when we are alive, and that is not simply the brain providing chemical signals to neurons and so on. It's very interesting. This goes back to a discussion I first discovered in one of Aldous Huxley's books, The Doors of Perception, where he talked about his experiences with mescaline in the 1950s. And he wrote very, very cogently about his experience and tried to explain how what he was feeling under the influence of that substance was a different reality, that somehow he interpreted his brain as having been in a state of filtering reality. And under the influence of mescaline, something cracked in the filter, and he perceived a different reality. Now, if you look at the evidence from autistic savants, and these are individuals that typically have brain damage but can do extraordinary things,
mm-hmm.
I think you find that there's evidence that the brain is not the source of consciousness, rather is a filter of consciousness, so that in principle we would have access to a universal sea of information if our brain didn't filter this out. Let me give a couple of examples. An autistic savant named Daniel Tammet can't tell right from left, but he can multiply two three-digit numbers together while carrying on a conversation.
Mm-hmm.
He's also recited the value of pi to 22,514 decimal places in a four-hour recital.
Amazing.
And he does this not by memorizing something, but by visualizing shapes. So it's as if somehow his damaged brain has a crack in the filter that lets the information that we usually filter out, because it's rather difficult to live life if you're accessing universal consciousness all the time, he has access to things that I wouldn't think that a human could do. Kim Peek is another example. He was the character that Dustin Hoffman played in Rain Man.
Yes.
Kim Peek has perfect recall of 7,600 books. He can read two pages simultaneously, one with each eye. And he memorizes telephone directories for recreation.
Amazing.
So I think that the evidence from autistic savants may be good evidence that our brain is not the source of our consciousness, but rather our brain is a filter that lets a tiny bit of universal consciousness through, just enough to let us live lives that seem to be normal and rational and bounded by the things of Earth, but that really are just a tiny fraction of the consciousness that lies behind the universe and that we are a part of.
My guest today is Bernard Hisch, and his book is The God Theory, Universes, Zero-Point Fields, and What's Behind It All. And as an astrophysicist and a man who has explored the world of science for many, many years, he's done a lot of study. He's a man of deep faith of his own level and belief, and he feels that there's a compatibility and an understanding here. And his thoughts, believe me, will shake up your gray cells if you're willing to explore, because it'll give you perspectives you never thought possible. You have some different points of information you bring out. One is called the inflation theory. Actually, you called it the Goldilocks theory. What is the Goldilocks theory?
Well, it's a way to try to explain why our universe is just right. I said earlier that there were at least seven properties of the universe that had to be just right for life to evolve here. And those are such things as the ratio of electrical to gravitational force, the strength of the nuclear force, the quantum fluctuations of matter density in the early universe. It goes on. There are several more of them. And these are values that physical constants take that could have been, for all we know, very, very different than what they are. But in some cases, if they were different by only a few percent from what they are, it would not have been possible for life to evolve here in the entire universe. So the question is, how come things are just right? Why is the universe in such a Goldilocks state to allow us to be here and to function and for life to have evolved on this planet? And by the way, I'm not in any way challenging the Big Bang theory or evolution. I think both those things are perfectly fine and, you know, a perfectly good way for life to evolve in the universe for a transcendent consciousness to fulfill its purpose, which we can get into in a minute. But the idea of a Goldilocks universe is how to explain why these properties are just right. Well, there are two ways to do that. One way is to say, well, there must be an infinite number of other universes because this one is just right, and the only way that can happen by chance is if there are an infinite number of others, and this one is just right because we couldn't be anyplace else to see something that's not right. The alternative explanation is that there is a consciousness behind this, that some universal transcendent consciousness created this universe and other universes, possibly, in order to do something. And that doing something, I believe, is to experience reality as a life form. This idea actually goes back to some extent to the writings of Sir James Jeans. He was one of the leading astrophysicists of the 1920s and 1930s. In fact, he even has a crater on the moon named after him. And he wrote, and let me give you a quote from his book. He wrote, "The universe begins to look more like a great thought than like a great machine. Mind no longer appears as an accidental intruder into the realm of matter. We are beginning to suspect that we ought rather to hail it as the creator and governor of the realm of matter." And it's that line of thinking that I've been following, that the universe is not a great machine. Rather, the universe is a great thought, a great product of consciousness. And that is that brings us back to the Goldilocks theory.
You have a statement in here about zeroing in on the zero-point field. And Alfonso Ruda was a man that had a significant influence on your interest. Who is Alfonso?
Alfonso Ruda is a professor at California State University at Long Beach, a very brilliant man. He got his degrees from MIT and Cornell. And he and I have collaborated on a series of papers that look at the physics of the zero-point field. Now, I've got to say the zero-point field is a very touchy subject because if you get online and look up zero-point field, you'll find an awful lot of speculation and an awful lot of, frankly, nonsense. Now, what we have done is to do research about the zero-point field using the techniques of stochastic electrodynamics. In fact, we had Alfonso and I had funding from NASA headquarters, and I had funding from Lockheed Martin, and we published papers in top-notch physics journals to look at the possibility that the zero-point field might be responsible for inertia in matter. This is important both for physics and potentially for metaphysics, because one of the great mysteries is why does matter have the property of mass? in physics that comes down to a search for a Higgs field. But what we were proposing was that the zero-point field may be the agent responsible for matter acquiring the property of mass. Well, this led me to think that acquiring the property of mass may have something to do with creation itself, and might even suggest a deep connection between esoteric references to light and the modern view of the zero-point field as a form of electromagnetic radiation. So it's that kind of speculative connection that I talk about in the book, and that is perhaps where I go the most out on a limb in trying to draw a connection between modern physics, modern science, and some esoteric views on the nature of creation.
This is so fascinating because there are so many people that have held certain positions of a metaphysical thought for even centuries. And now that science is evolving into its level of study and investigation, it's as if they are starting to come together. Why is it that there is such a distrust between science and the various organizations throughout the world?
Well, there's a distrust of science and religion because, after all, scientists were persecuted. Giordano Bruno was burned at the stake in 1600. Galileo did not have a very pleasant experience with the Catholic Church. So the two wound up in a state of enmity hundreds of years ago. And I think that there is a very understandable sense in science that never again will we allow such atrocities to happen. Never again will we allow the human spirit to be repressed by religious dogma. And I can understand that, and that makes sense. But I think the pendulum has swung too far the other direction, in that science has become kind of a religion unto itself, with its dogmas being almost the inverse of the religious dogmas. And I think that it's really time for the two to put aside their mutual animosities and come together and see whether in this century we can begin to understand some of the really profound aspects of reality that go beyond merely the physical and incorporate things like the nature of consciousness and the existence of realities beyond our physical universe. I think these are legitimate questions for science to explore, and that's still in a state of denial in science today.
You have here one sentence that I was fascinated with. Space and time are not distinct phenomena as they appear to be in everyday life. I've often said over the years, there's no such thing as space or time. But what is your interpretation of that?
Well, actually, that statement is really pretty conventional. I was simply talking about special relativity in that section of the book. It has to do with the fact that, as Einstein showed, it's depending upon how things are moving with respect to each other, one person's time can, in a sense, become another person's space, and one person's space another time. And I mean that in a very rigorous and literal sense. We have what are called the Lorentz transformation of coordinate frames. And so without getting too technical, I'm referring basically to Einstein's description of reality in terms of a four-dimensional space-time. So I wouldn't put anything very metaphysical as an interpretation of that particular discussion in the book.
You suggest the solid, stable world of matter is sustained at every entrance by an underlying sea of quantum light. That's a very descriptive sentence.
Well, this goes back to what I was talking about regarding the zero-point field. In fact, if people want to have a bit more background on where these ideas come from, I suggest they go to the website for my book, which is thegodtheory.com. I have a lot of questions and answers and even some excerpts from the book in thegodtheory.com. But going back to your question about the quantum underlying quantum sea of light, I'm referring again to the zero-point field, because the zero-point field is interpreted as originating in quantum laws. Quantum laws very clearly predict that there should be a background sea of quantum energy that permeates the universe everywhere. The question is this real? Is it really real? Is it virtually real? How to treat this? And in the techniques we use in this area of physics called stochastic electrodynamics, we simply take this quantum field as real and investigate its interactions with matter. And the interesting thing that we found under the NASA study and the Lockheed Martin study was that it may be possible to explain why things acquire the property of mass because of their motion through this sea of zero-point light, zero-point energy. And that's really intriguing because that implies that there may be sort of at the bottom of creation, underpinning creation itself, some form of quantum radiation, quantum light, which is pretty suggestive of what you find in some of the esoteric literature.
That's true. You have a wonderful attitude, and I just think that this kind of attitude should be passed along to the youth of our world. Adults can have it too, but I really would love to see the youth of our country and around the world excited that the age of exploration is only beginning. I really like your attitude about that. I like the fact that you say that we're not exhausting our fields of research. We just are not taking time to be aware of all the phenomenal possibilities. That's exciting.
Well, it is. I think the world really needs something to believe in. And I wrote this book really as a public service because I think that in between the hardcore skeptics that dismiss everything with a sneer and the faithful who get their beliefs full-blown from the prophets and preachers and believe in some of the, unfortunately, fairy tales of religions, in between those two, there are millions of people looking to believe in something, looking for a purpose in their lives, that are put off by both sides of this chasm. And I'm trying to provide something that is plausible and rational and believable, and that will give a sense of purpose, a genuine purpose, to the lives of human beings everywhere, and that will therefore contribute to peace and harmony in the world, because we very badly need that, and we very badly need to put some of the religious misconceptions behind us.
My guest today has been Bernard Hisch. His wonderful book, The God Theory, getting ideas that perhaps will spark your own curiosity if you have been on the edge of exploring new thoughts, new ideas. This is a book that is easy reading. It is thought-provoking, but more than anything else, it's going to enable you as an individual to go, I wonder. Bernard Hisch is my guest. Thank you so very much. What's your website now? You say it's thegodtheory.com. That's where people need to go?
Thegodtheory.com.
Thegodtheory.com, and you'll get all kinds of additional information. And, of course, you can order the book through that website. You can go to Amazon.com, any of the local bookstores. Bernard, if you could leave my audience with a thought today, what would you like that to be?
That it's possible to believe in science and to believe in God, and that both of them are aspects of reality that can provide a purpose for your life.
Very, very good words, strong words, and wise ones, I think. I really appreciate your being my guest today. This is Donna Sebo, and again, this is Bernard Hisch, who has been my guest. The God Theory is the name of his book. He talks about universes, zero-point fields, and what's behind it all. Again, this comes from a positioning of a man who has a passion for research. He has a passion for life. Why not find out more about what his curiosity has brought into his own world of experience? It might enhance yours in a very special way. This is Donna Sebo. We're going to be taking a break for just a moment. When we come back, telephone lines will be open. You can call in to 877-876-5227 if you'd like to chat with me today. Donna Sebo here. Don't you go away, because when we come back, we've got a lot more good things to share with you. Don't forget, thegodtheory.com is Bernard's website. You can go in there and find out all kinds of good information. Thegodtheory.com, and the book also is available. We'll be back in just a moment. Don't you go away now. Hi, this is Donna Sebo, and there's just so much to share with you today. I hope you had an absolutely awesome weekend. I know I did. And why did I have such a good time? Well, I was participating in the Washington Renaissance Fantasy Fair. Oh, my goodness, what a time. It's so magical to be in a place where at one moment it's just nothing more than a barren piece of land, and within 24 hours, it's transformed into the 16th century, castle entrance in place, and it's absolutely magical. And I want to invite you, we have two weekends, this coming weekend of the 12th and the 13th, and also the 19th and the 20th, here in Gig Harbor, Washington, at the Mentor Creek Ranch. It is a wonderful experience. All of the entertaining, the jousting, the equestrian events, There's gypsy dancing, storytelling, musical performances. Oh, the music is just wonderful. And, of course, there's just so much more that you can see. And all you need to do, if you want to get your tickets in advance, go to WashingtonRenFair.com. That's Washington, RENFAIRE.com. And you can go in there and you can get tickets. And you know what? You get a discount when you buy through their website. And it keeps you from having to stand in the long line. We had people standing outside of the castle entrance to come into the fair. My goodness, they were lined up an hour ahead. It's that exciting for people. And there's just so much entertainment that goes on throughout this event. Food is fabulous. Entertainment is just key, and absolutely wonderful. And you know, one of the things I have so much fun with is watching the kids. I love to see their eyes when they see people in costume. We even have a giant that's about 12 feet tall. He's just huge. And the kids, their eyes just get as big as saucers, and they go, wow. And they're able to shake hands with this giant. And there's just so many other wonderful, wonderful things go on. So I hope you come on out and look for me, because I am in a booth there. You'll see my booth with the bright golden yellow banners with the giant red lions on them. And you can't miss it. Come on in and say hello. And I'm there doing mini counseling for people. And also I have a lot of books on sale. So go into WashingtonRenFair.com. We have the next 2 weekends where we're going to be open. You can go to their website, like I said, WashingtonRenFair.com. Their 800 number is 359-5948. And just know you're going to have the time of your life. This is Donna Sebo, and telephone lines are open if you would like to call in and chat with me. Give me a buzz at 877-876-5227. All I need from you is your first name or your initial. And then after that, just let me tell you what I perceive, and then you're welcome to ask me a question about anything that you like. I also wanted to share with you a wonderful, wonderful, I don't know who sent this to me. It's a story that is something that makes you just realize you need to think about some things. And since we were dealing with an astrophysicist earlier in the show, I think that the aspect of thinking is a very good one. There was a young man who was very uncertain of his future, and he decided to leave his home and travel the world because he wanted to find out the meaning of life. Well, one day he meets an old man at a remote village temple, and the old man spies the young man, and he says, "Oh, I think you're looking for something. You just have that look about you. I can tell." The young man proceeded to tell the elderly gentleman, "I'm on a quest. I want to discover the meaning of life. I've traveled thousands of miles from home and met many people who shared their wisdom with me, but I just don't feel any closer to the truth than when I started." The old man asked him a question. "What have you learned so far?" The young man thought for a moment. He said, "Well, I met a prophet who lived for so many years in the desert. He told me that life is an oasis for all of your heart's desires." Gentleman he was sharing this with said, "That's true, very true." Young man continued. He said, "I also met a poet who told me that life is like a rose, beautiful yet thorny at the same time." The old man responded, "That's very, very true." Well, the young man was getting a little agitated, and he said to the elderly gentleman, "But how can both be true? I'm confused. Shouldn't there just be one truth?" The old man looked at the young man and just sort of smiled, and he just watched him for a moment or two, and he said, "My friend, there is no one answer to your question. Don't you see? The answer is personal. It comes from within. You yourself shape the meaning of your life. For me, life is a vessel full of memories. For you, life is an endless journey of discovery." And isn't that true? There is so much we go through in life, and I don't know about you, but there's so often been times in my life I thought, gee, there's only one way of doing something. There's only one way of thinking. There's got to be this black and white part of life. Perhaps because I'm mature in years, and I look at it and I go, you know, I can reflect back on my life and I find a lot that I thought was going to be black and white turns out to be purple and green and yellow. It's not black and white. And I think a good example is to take a look at Mother Nature. Do you notice all of the many variables in Mother Nature? Just last night, we were watching a program about frogs on television. Someone had taken time to do research about frogs in Cuba. And there's this little itsy-bitsy frog. He's less than a third of an inch long. You can put him on your thumbnail, and he's so tiny. He's smaller than a fly. Little tiny guy. That scientist had to do a lot of studying, a lot of research, had to be out digging and perceiving all kinds of things until he was able to see this itsy-bitsy little frog. Life is full of so many variables. Just when we think we know it all, life comes along and gives us a little whammy smack and says, excuse me, you need to go to door number 4. You've been to number 1, number 2, and number 3, but there's number 4, then there's number 5, there's number 6, there's number 7. You need to enjoy the aspect of curiosity about life. And don't be disappointed if you find that things are not in little boxes. It's okay. Be glad that you're the individual that has the opportunity to expand your world, to expand your life, and to stretch yourself in brand new directions. It's marvelous, absolutely marvelous, and totally exciting. Norman C. McGranahan made a comment that I think applies to this little story that I shared with you. When a man begins to understand himself, he begins to live. When he begins to live, he begins to understand his fellow men. When you begin to live, I'm going to stretch this little quote a little bit longer. When you begin to live, you realize you're going to understand more than just people. You're going to have a greater understanding of yourself. And you'll also have a greater understanding of life. And I think of the scientist we had on today, he's still exploring. He's never stated that he's only got one understanding of anything. He said, this is where I am right now at this moment, and this has just opened my world, and this is what I want to share with you. It hasn't stopped his curiosity. It hasn't stopped him investigating new things. And so it should be with you. Don't shut the door on life. Remember, life, when you were born, opened itself up in the way of many opportunities. Won't you reach out for a few? And I know sometimes there will be disappointments. However, realize that sometimes those disappointments can be spurs for entirely different action. And it may change your life 180 degrees. This is Donna Sebo. If you'd like to chat with me today, give me a buzz. We have a toll-free number of 877-876-5227, and I'd be delighted to light up your life with a little insight. I want to share with you some of the people that are going to be coming on with me this week and next. Tomorrow, we're going to be talking with Susan O'Brien. She's got a gluten-free cookbook. So many of you out there are not happy with grains. Your body doesn't like it. You've got these allergies. Well, this is something that I think you'll find very insightful and very useful. Also, we're going to be talking with Carol Edmonston. This lady, I've interviewed her before. She's called the Doodle Lady, and she's just a doll. And she's got wonderful, wonderful stories to share and how doodling can really make a difference in your life. And also, we're going to be talking with Alan Botkin. We're going to be talking about induced after-death communication. Sound provocative? Well, you're going to have to stay tuned to hear it. And then we're going to be talking with Dr. Diamond about facets of a diamond, and it's a different perspective than perhaps what you would think with a title. And then Perry Garfinkel, who is a photographer for the National Geographic, well, he's going to be our guest as talking about Buddha or Bust, his travels around the world. Well, we're going to find that really interesting. And then Jin Singh. This is called A Divine Root. David Taylor is going to be educating us about that wonderful root that has so many health-giving benefits. And if you want to know about how to communicate with orcas, well, we're going to have a lady, Mary Getton. She is in the Northwest, Pacific Northwest, and she is going to be sharing with us some phenomenal experiences she has. And also, if you want to turn your world around, we're going to be talking with Jared Rosen, his book called The Flip. So we have so many wonderful people, provocative, well, thoughtful subjects, and I think those that may make you think about life a little differently. Of course, personally empowering you is what this show is all about, and I'm delighted to share it with you. Now, by the way, if you need to get in touch with me for any reason, you would like to perhaps have a private session with me, give me a call at 800-872-8852. Also, if you have a story, a recipe, or something special you'd like to share with me, send it along to Donna@DelphiInternational.com. That's Donna@DelphiInternational.com, and that's DelphiInternational.com, and I will be delighted to respond to you. I love to hear from you, and it just means a lot when you take the time to do exactly that. And I've had some people say, you know, Donna, we would really like to get your newsletter. Just send me an email. That's all it takes. Well, I know we're going to be going to break pretty soon. I've got a cute little story to share with you that someone sent me from Minnesota. And also, if we have time, I'm going to share with you a quick dish, a recipe for an Asian shrimp rice bowl. Fast, easy, and you know when it's hot, you don't like to spend a whole bunch of time in the kitchen. So get that pad of paper handy and a pen, and you'll be able to write this down. It's so quick and easy. You will just absolutely love it. Donna Sebo here. Give me a buzz if you'd like to chat with me while we're on air today, 877-876-5227. We're going to be back in just a moment. Don't you go away now. Hi, this is Donna Sebo. Okay, I promised you a couple of things here. First, let me share this cute little story that it's a thoughtful one that was sent to me by Lon, and he said there was one day a father of a very wealthy family took his son on a trip to the country with the express purpose of showing him how poor people live. They spent a couple of days and nights on the farm of what would be considered a very poor family. On the return from their trip, the father asked his son, "How was the trip?" "Oh, it was great, Dad. Did you see how poor people live?" the father asked. "Oh, yeah." "So tell me, what did you learn from the trip?" The son answered, "I saw that we have one dog. They had four. We have a pool that reaches to the middle of our garden, and they have a creek that has no end. We have imported lanterns in our garden, and they have the stars at night. Our patio reaches to the front yard, and they have the whole horizon. We have a small piece of land to live on, and they have fields that go beyond our sight. We have servants that serve us, but they serve others. We buy our food, but they grow theirs. We have walls around our property to protect us. They have friends to protect them." The boy's father was really quite surprised by his son's response. Then his son added, "Thanks, Dad, for showing me how poor we are." A different perspective. Sometimes we don't realize what we have and what we don't have. And I think the little boy's response, or the young man's response, I should say, gave a different insight as to how things can be viewed to his father. And sometimes we just need to remember that. So I want to thank my listener for sending that in to me. Okay, and here's the recipe, the Asian shrimp rice bowl. Now, this is what we've got. It's real, real simple. It'll just take a short period of time, and everybody will think you'd spend hours. So all you need to do, you can use your favorite mix of frozen vegetables, and, you know, there's packages of these stir-fried vegetables, so this really makes it easy. Now, all you need is one package, about 12 ounces, of frozen, fully cooked, peeled, and deveined medium shrimp. And you can substitute chicken or beef for whatever you like. But this is the shrimp rice bowl. And then a package, a 16-ounce package of frozen vegetable mix, whatever you like. Then you need about 3 tablespoons of Asian sesame ginger salad dressing. A teaspoon of light soy sauce. And then 2 packages, about 8.5 ounces each of, if you like, microwavable long grain and wild rice mixture, and those you get at the store too. And then you need about 1/4 cup of unsalted dry roasted peanuts, and those are optional. You might want to substitute almonds or walnuts or something like that. And then 1 tablespoon of chopped cilantro, fresh, and then 1 teaspoon of toasted sesame seeds, and again, those are also, you know, optional too. So if you don't like cilantro, use fresh parsley. That works just as nicely. But when it's fresh, that's when it's best. And again, the seeds, maybe you like some other kinds of seeds. Toss it on if you don't like the sesame seeds. Now, all you have to do, and this is all done in the microwave, you can put your shrimp and vegetables, you microwave on medium until they're thawed, and then toss them in, you know, you're going to, for 3 to 5 minutes, stirring in a, you know, in a pan just allow them to cook a little bit more, because you want the veggies crisp. You don't want them overcooked. And then you stir in your dressing and your soy sauce, and then microwave on medium, stirring occasionally until heated through 3 to 5 minutes, cover to keep warm, and then fix your rice according to package directions. And you've got 4 servings here. For a family, is just great. If you want, stir in peanuts and cilantro into your mixture, and again, serve it right over your rice. Real, real simple. If you don't have a microwave and you want to use a pan, go ahead and do it. Just add a little bit of oil, or if you're trying to keep fat low in your diet, just add a little bit of broth in there and cooking your shrimp and your vegetables. It's fast, it's quick, it's easy, and the flavors are just wonderful. So I figured you would enjoy that summer easy recipe to use to satisfy yourself and your family, maybe even your friends. It's also very good for entertaining because it makes a beautiful, beautiful dish. And you can double or triple this recipe. It's really, really nice. I know when I gave a dinner party recently, I wanted to have the Asian theme with my food. And so I found that I was able to get prepared chicken. It was already cut up into pieces, and I made a sauce that went through it, and it was just absolutely awesome. Cooked a few almonds in a pan and butter and just scattered those on top, and people just loved it. It was real, real simple. And I think that's the joy and ease of Asian food. Of course, it's all the preparation that goes into it first. But, oh, it's so good, and you've got so many wonderful flavors that you can enjoy. Don't forget, tomorrow we're going to be talking about how to cook without those gluten products. We're going to have gluten-free recipes for you tomorrow by Susan O'Brien. So that is just going to be a wonderful, wonderful time. So have those pads of paper in handy tomorrow when we talk, because you're going to want to make notes about what she shares with you. This is Donna Sebo. We have so much that we like to share with you every day. I want to encourage you to give me a call if you have a special story, or if you send it to me by email, that's even better. Also know that BBS has changed a lot of things with their formats and layouts with the show. When you come into the website, be sure and tell your friends that they will need to log in so that they can hear all of the wonderful programming that goes on here. And don't forget, we're here with you every afternoon, Pacific time, 3 to 4. For those of you in the Midwest, it is 5 to 6, and on the East Coast, 6 to 7. So be sure to share it with your friends. And don't forget, come on out and see me at the Washington Renaissance Fantasy Fair, because that is an event that's going on for the next 2 weekends. It is marvelous fun, costumes. Yes, I'm wearing my fancy dresses and just enjoying it. It's 2 more weekends of great family fun. Go to WashingtonRenFair.com, because you are going to see truly knights in shining armor. You're going to see beautiful ladies in gorgeous outfits. You will see all kinds of people with their crafts and their wares. It's exciting. It's a wonderful adventure to participate in. Go to WashingtonRenFair.com, and you can get your discounted tickets through there, and you can find out quite a bit of information. If you want, you can call their 800 number, 359-5948. That's 800-359-5948. We have people from all over the country that come in just to be at this Renaissance Fair. They stay over for the weekend. Sometimes they're there for a full week's vacation here in the Pacific Northwest at Gig Harbor at the Mender Creek Ranch. They'll come in on the weekends and visit and just have a wonderful, wonderful time. Donna Sebo here. I know we're out of time. Remember always that you are the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul. It's so good to spend this time with you. Tell your friends, and just know that you're going to be able to light up life in a very special way just by being the best you can possibly be. Donna Sebo here. We'll be back with you right in Sassy tomorrow. Have a great one, and do take time to enjoy the beauty around you. There's a lot of it. Bye for now. Talk with you tomorrow.